Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote the Pints Historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I'm very well acquainted, too, with matters mathematical. I understand equations both as simple and quadratical. About binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news. Ooh, lot of news, lot of news. Got it. With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. Very good at integral and differential calculus. I know the scientific names of beings animalculous. In short, imagine vegetable, animal, and mineral. I am the very model of a modern major general. I know I'm epic history, King Arthur's answer, Cather, Doctor.
Everybody, I am Daniel McCarthy, and this is, finally, another episode of the Story of Nowhere podcast. And yes, this is the Big Bad British Empire episode I've been talking so much about for such a long time. I think I actually decided that I wanted to do this show back in, like, April, or maybe even in March. And then I finally started to actually get to work on it in May, I want to say. And it's been a long process, it's been difficult at times, but here it is. And just in time for the one-year anniversary of my marriage and of this show. So thank you all very much for listening over this past year and hopefully on into the future. And most of all, thank you to Alice. I don't know what I'd do without your cooking. Okay, so on the subject of this episode, it was originally going to be shorter. It was going to be not quite an off-the-cuff episode, but also not quite a deep, deep, deep dive episode, something in between. But it didn't work out that way. It wound up becoming very, 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 very long as I continued to work on it and delve into different aspects of what I was studying. So I wound up deciding that rather than waiting and waiting to put this thing out there as one complete podcast, I'm going to release it in parts. I'm thinking probably it'll end up being three parts, but you know how these things go. That could very easily change. Now, because it wound up being a deep dive, I want to stress to everyone listening, check out the show notes, please. They're available at storyofnowhere.com/Britannia1. They're very extensive, very comprehensive, and I took a long time to put them together for you, so please don't let that work be in vain. But also, just because the notes are included, and just because I have a lot of excerpts included for various sources in those notes, you're still going to get the most out of this material by actually clicking into the links and doing your own research, doing your own reading. So I implore you to really dig into the source material here, and again, that's all available for you at storyofnowhere.com/Britannia1. Now, in the concluding part of this series, I'm really going to spend a lot of time getting into why this series is actually relevant, why it's important to study the utopian origins and aims of the British Empire. So I'm not going to spend too much time spoiling the ending for you here in the introduction, but I will say this. The British Empire is the macroist of microcosms of modern civilization that's available to us to study. It began as an explicitly Protestant empire at the very beginning of the Reformation. It revived and modified classical pre-medieval political concepts at the dawn of the English Renaissance. It was fueled by a unique sort of, I guess you could say, special relationship between the public and private sectors. And it was, as we'll see later on, based ideologically on the belief that the extension of Britishness could and would lead to a global utopia. This much is fairly common knowledge. What's less commonly known is that the imminent British utopia was based, in part, on a collection of rhetoric regarding an ancient, long-lost utopia. So in this first episode, we're really going to just set the context for the ideological rise of the empire by focusing on the mythological and political context that preceded the creation of the empire itself. Next time, we'll look at the mythological and utopian rhetoric that was actually in the air when people first started to speak of a British Empire, and actually, in the next show, we will see the empire arise, historically. And then in conclusion, we will discuss how all of this relates to the later empire, as well as how it relates to us today. Because that's really the point of this series. It's to learn about how modern global power structures actually function by examining and learning about the rise of the British Empire, which, as I said, is the macroist of microcosms. So, if you're familiar with the work of Carol Quigley and Richard Grove, Kevin Cole, the Tragedy and Hope community, then this is definitely going to be a must-listen show for you. With that said, I want to get right to it, but first I'm just going to say thank you once again to everyone who's listening. I've gotten a little bump in listenership and subscribership since the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, so thank you all to the new listeners. Also, I've gotten a slight bump from my appearance on the School Sucks podcast, so thank you to all of you new listeners as well. Remember to recommend this podcast and the book to anyone you know who may be interested in this kind of thing. Also, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to help me out, buy the book. That would be fantastic. Thank you all once again, and let's get to it. Myth, Empire, and Utopia. The Rise and Rule of Britannia. Part 1. Myth and Empire. Britain's First 2700 Years. Chapter 1. Myth and Motive. Human beings are animals, trying to make sense of the world. We study causes and effects, hoping to detect the faint threads of a tapestry of sense binding everything together. To do this, some people subject the material world to rigorous and repeatable tests. However, while such tests may answer the question, how, they don't answer the true question of cause. They don't answer why. To satisfy our terrible desire to answer this impossible question, our species has, for millennia upon millennia, told stories. Stories about the world. Stories about ourselves, stories about gods and heroes and devils and villains and forces beyond comprehension. We have always, and will always, concoct cultural tales to explain and or justify why things are the way they are. We call these tales myths. Myths do more than just provide us with a comforting sense of understanding. The sense of understanding determines, to a large degree, the actions we will take. Who we think we are and what we think the world is deeply impacts our decisions and behaviors as individuals and as societies. While myths are intended to account for the causes of things, they themselves become causes of human action. Therefore, if we are to understand the actions of an individual or of a society, we must come to appreciate the myths that motivate those actions. How does that person or those people make sense of his, her, or their place in the world? Notice that I've said nothing regarding the veracity of a given myth. This is an absolutely crucial point. For the purposes of this presentation, a myth only refers to a story which attempts to make sense of the world. A myth can be totally false, or it could be totally true, or it could be somewhere in between. The actual truth or falsity of a myth is largely irrelevant. I'm not saying that truth itself is irrelevant, only that people will act on myths they believe in, regardless of the degree to which those myths correspond with reality. This is so for cultural myths which have arisen organically over time, as it is with myths which have been deliberately crafted and disseminated by individuals with ulterior motives, who wish to effectively hijack the way people make sense of the world in order to suit their own purposes. Myths vary from culture to culture, from time to time. Yet, we are all human, and we do all live on the same planet. So myths tend to bear certain similarities. There are certain universal sorts of myths. There are flood myths, for example, resurrection myths, dragon myths, and many more found all over the world. Our concern today is with the first sort of universal myth, if I may, the origin myth. Chapter 2. The Origin Myth. At first glance, the origin myth is fairly straightforward. However, it can be divided into two separate, though closely related, types. First, there is the cosmic origin myth, the creation myth. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Of course, such myths are ubiquitous. Everyone's got one. Aside from the Genesis account, there's the Babylonian story of Apsu and Tiamat, the Greek Chaos, the Hindu Brahma. Even the Big Bang is an origin myth, in that it's a narrative which explains the creation of the universe. And indeed, ascribing to this myth is likely to inform one's actions. Each of these narratives is supposed to explain the unexplainable. Though, despite what the adherents to any given one of them may say, none of these can completely or definitively tell us how, much less why, anything exists at all. Nevertheless, because we cannot help but see the effects of creation all around us, we likewise cannot help but try to come up with a cause for it all. Though the cosmic origin myth is concerned with the creation of the entire universe, it almost invariably zooms in to focus on one society in particular. Of course, this would be the society to which the myth belongs. The Hebrew creation story zooms in on the Hebrews, the Babylonian creation story zooms in on the Babylonians. You get the idea. So this takes us to the second type of origin myth, the societal origin myth, which is a basis of today's study. A societal origin myth tells the story of how a society came into being. Typically, the societal origin myth will portray the society as being unique and superior to all other societies, usually because it has a special connection to the god or gods that created the universe in their cosmic origin myth. Depending on the myth, it may be quite some time after creation that the society is formed. For instance, in the Judeo-Christian narrative, assuming a literal interpretation of the Bible, thousands of years pass between the creation of the heaven and the earth and God's covenant with Abraham. In the case of the ancient Greeks and Romans, it's not even the creator gods that establish the various Greco-Roman societies, but their great-great-grandchildren. Still, in both cases, the societal origin is consistent with the cosmic origin. In the beginning of the book of Genesis, God promises that he will establish a line of chosen people. And in the Greco-Roman worldview, the gods who meddle in human affairs are descended from the gods that created the universe. It's often the case, and indeed it is the case in both Judeo-Christian mythology and Greco-Roman mythology, that between the creation of the world and the establishment of the society in question, there's a period known as a Golden Age. In the Bible, there's Eden, and in Greco-Roman lore, the Golden Age of Kronos, or Saturn. These Golden Ages are, for all intents and purposes, completely and entirely utopian. They represent human society as it's supposed to be, what it was once like before being tainted, often by external forces. Satan slithered into Eden as a serpent and corrupted its pure inhabitants. Likewise, Prometheus brought human beings fire and knowledge and vain hope. Such primordial golden ages, which immediately follow the creation of the universe, depict an entirely different sort of human being than we are at present. Thus, many religions argue that we can only return to such perfect conditions by way of catastrophic divine intervention. There are, however, other, less demanding golden ages. Not primordial golden ages that follow the creation of the universe, but golden ages which coincide with or even follow the societal origin myth. For instance, the late colonial and early republican periods of the United States, or rather the mythic way in which this era is presented, is an example of a golden age. Of course, this was by no means an Edenic, peaceful time. The most defining event of the period was a massive war. But, as it's commonly presented, it is a golden age, because it was a time when people and society were different, better. Strong men fought for what was right. They were valorous and daring, and in creating a new sort of society based on the ideals of liberty, they opened the door for the whole world to do the same. In short, the Americans of the Revolutionary period are what Americans are supposed to be like. This golden age in American history offers us the mythic essence of what America is. Given America's mythic history, it's no wonder so many modern conservatives want to get back to the Constitution, just like Christians await the Second Coming and the return to paradise that follows it. That's the whole point of golden ages. You wanna get back to them. I've already said that myths inform people's actions. Societal origin myths, particularly when there's a corresponding golden age, are especially influential in that they posit an end for a society, a purpose, a goal, a teleology. Such tales also reveal what a society sees as its essential characteristics, and they then portray how wonderful everything would be if only everybody unwaveringly adopted those characteristics. And not for nothing, the existence of a past golden age lends credibility to the possibility of a future golden age. We've been there before, so we can get there again, right? In short, these stories leave us with a blueprint for utopia. Therefore, the study of such myths and legends is absolutely crucial in the larger field of utopian studies. In this presentation, we will examine the societal origin and Golden Age myths that informed one of history's most ambitious and notorious utopian projects, and observe the long-lasting and far-reaching effects of this scheme, and the tales of a legendary past as they relate to our modern world. Chapter 3. Britain. At its peak in the early 20th century, the British Empire covered over 20% of the Earth's landmass, and likewise, over 20% of the Earth's population was said to be subject to the sovereignty of the Crown. It's no wonder that it was said that the sun never sets on the British Empire. At any given time, the sun was always shining on one colony or another. Such was the grandeur and the splendor of Britannia. This empire to end all empires didn't just pop up out of nowhere. Well, actually, maybe it did come out of nowhere. It began in part as a project to reestablish a long-past golden age and create a global utopia, nowhere land. In part. The commercial motivations behind the creation and sustenance of the empire cannot be overstated. Economy was the lifeblood of the British Empire, and I will spend some time discussing that economy later on. Nevertheless, while resources and raw data are essential to any empire, so too is conviction. Golden Age rhetoric played a key role in getting the empire off the ground and into the sea, as it were, and certainly utopian ideology was a driving motivational force behind some of the late empire's most zealous and influential exponents. But we'll come to all of that in due time. Before getting into the late imperialists and their vision of a British world order, before even getting to the Golden Age myth that fostered the idea of a British Empire in the first place, we must cover the societal origin myth of Britain itself, from which the later Golden Age sprang. Then we'll look at the very real political context of Britain just before the Empire began. But first, the origin myth. Chapter 4. Aeneas. Like any chunk of land with people on it, Britain has an origin myth, which ties its people to the land. Our story begins in what the ancient Greek poet and curmudgeon Hesiod called the Heroic Age, a time when gods trod the earth and when noble and honorable men of divine descent competed for their favor. It was an age of valor, of conquest, and of victory. As Genesis 6:4 puts it, "There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown." Men of renown. One of these men of renown, son of the sons of God and the daughters of men, or in this particular case, son of the daughters of God and the sons of men, was Aeneas, a great warrior from the ancient city of Troy, whose mother was the goddess Aphrodite. In the Trojan War, the great war of the heroic age, as documented by the blind bard Homer in his Iliad, Aeneas did battle with the Argive champion Achilles, who was himself the son of the goddess Thetis. Aeneas was first to stride forward and attack, his doughty helmet tossing defiance as he came on. He held his strong shield before his breast and brandished his bronze spear. The son of Peleus from the other side sprang forth to meet him, like some fierce lion that the whole countryside has met to hunt and kill. At first he bodes no ill, but when some daring youth has struck him with a spear, he crouches open-mouthed. His jaws foam, he roars with fury, he lashes his tail from side to side about his ribs and loins, and glares as he springs straight before him to find out whether he is to slay or to be slain among the foremost of his foes. Even with such fury did Achilles burn to spring upon Aeneas. Aeneas would then have struck Achilles as he was springing toward him, either on the helmet or on the shield that covered him, and Achilles would have closed with him and dispatched him with his sword, had not Poseidon, lord of the earthquake, been quick to mark, and said forthwith to the immortals, "Alas, I am sorry for great Aeneas, who will now go down to the house of Hades, vanquished by the son of Peleus, fool that he was to give ear to the counsel of Apollo. Apollo will never save him from destruction. Why should this man suffer when he is guiltless, to no purpose, and in another's quarrel? Has he not at all times offered acceptable sacrifice to the gods that dwell in heaven? Let us then snatch him from death's jaws, lest the son of Cronos be angry should Achilles slay him. It is fated, moreover, that he should escape, and that the race of Dardanus, whom Zeus loved above all the sons born to him of mortal women, should not perish utterly without seed or sign. For now indeed has Zeus hated the blood of Priam, while Aeneas shall reign over the Trojans, he and his children's children that shall be born hereafter." For Aeneas and his heirs, the gods had concocted a singular destiny. They were to rule not Troy, but the Trojans. Veneration of Aeneas as a great hero passed from Greece to Rome, where it was said that, after the Trojan War, Aeneas escaped the defeated Troy and fled to Italy. While there, he met and befriended the king Latinus, and eventually married his daughter Lavinia. The kingdom of Latinus was, predictably, known as Latium. It was in this land that Aeneas finally settled, and, through the actions of his legendary descendants, became the progenitor of Rome. In its entry for Aeneas, the online Encyclopedia Britannica says, quote, "As Rome expanded over Italy and the Mediterranean, its patriotic writers began to construct a mythical tradition that would at once dignify their land with antiquity and satisfy a latent dislike of Greek cultural superiority. The fact that Aeneas, as a Trojan, represented an enemy of the Greeks and that tradition left him free after the war made him peculiarly fit for the part assigned him, i.e., the founding of Roman greatness." Unquote. While a number of Roman sources in the last couple centuries BC credited Aeneas as such, the most detailed treatment of his story was written between 29 and 19 BC by the poet Virgil. The epic was called the Aeneid. Virgil documents the end of the Trojan War, and it's in this tale we learn of Aeneas's exploits after the war, his descent into the underworld, his eventual journey to the future site of Rome, and that he is a direct ancestor of the legendary founders of Rome, the famous twins who were suckled by a she-wolf, Romulus and Remus. Ilia the Fair, a priestess and a queen, who full of Mars in time with kindly throes, shall at a birth two godly boys disclose. The royal babes a tawny wolf shall drain, then Romulus his grandsire's throne shall gain. Of martial towers the founder shall become, the people Romans call the city of Rome. To them no bounds of empire I assign, nor term of years to their immortal line. Even haughty Juno, who with endless broils, earth, seas, and heaven, and Jove himself turmoils, at length atoned, her friendly power shall join, to cherish and advance the Trojan line. The subject world shall Rome's dominion own, and prostrate shall adore the nation of the gown. Written during the reign of Augustus Caesar, the first true Roman emperor, it comes as no surprise that Virgil asserts that Augustus, too, is descended from the Trojan hero. Though mythic accounts vary in the details, Aeneas and his offspring represent the origin point of the Roman race. But what of the British race? Chapter 5. Brutus. According to tradition, the AD 825 text Historia Britonum was written by the Welsh monk Nennius. This mysterious work claims that the people of Britain, the Britons, are all descended from an Aeneas-like figure of their own, a great hero named Brutus. Of course, a legendary founder is to be expected in an old pseudo-historical text. What may come as more of a surprise is the fact that, according to Nennius, Brutus was, in fact, a direct descendant of Aeneas. A more complete version of the story came around 1135 or so, when Geoffrey of Monmouth, a Welsh cleric inspired by the work of Nennius and other historians, authored Historia Regum Britanniae, the History of the Kings of Britain. This is the quintessential work describing the mythic age of Britain. Geoffrey begins his British Historia with the events that followed the destruction of Troy.
After the Trojan War, Aeneas, flying with Ascanius from the destruction of their city, sailed to Italy. There he was honorably received by King Latinus, which raised against him the envy of Turnus, king of the Rutuli, who thereupon made war against him. Upon then engaging in battle, Aeneas got the victory, and having killed Turnus, obtained the kingdom of Italy, and with it Lavinia, the daughter of Latinus. After his death, Ascanius, succeeding in the kingdom, built Alba upon the Tiber, and begat a son named Silvius, who in pursuit of a private amour took to wife a niece of Lavinia. The damsel soon after conceived, and the father Ascanius, coming to the knowledge of it, commanded his magicians to consult of what sex the child should be. When they had satisfied themselves in the matter, they told him she would give birth to a boy, who would kill his father and mother, and after travelling over many countries in banishment, would at last arrive at the highest pitch of glory. Nor were they mistaken in their prediction, for at the proper time the woman brought forth a son, and died of his birth. But the child was delivered to a nurse, and called Brutus. At length, after 15 years were expired, the youth accompanied his father in hunting, and killed him undesignedly by the shot of an arrow. For as the servants were driving up the deer towards him, Brutus, in shooting at them, smote his father under the breast. Upon his death, he was expelled from Italy, his kinsmen being enraged at him for so heinous a deed.
Here we meet a new character in the Aeneas drama, his great-grandson, who is given the name Brutus. It may be significant that Geoffrey characterizes Brutus as being a secret and incestuous son of Silvius and his own cousin. Though he hailed from the royal stock of Aeneas and carried the noble blood of the Trojan race in his veins, there was a curse around him. He was less than perfect. I'll speculate on the significance of this in just a few minutes. So Brutus was sent away. Like his great-grandfather before him, he traveled far and wide, and even passed through Greece. Traveling still farther west, Brutus and his band stopped to pray.
Presenting themselves before the shrine with garlands about their temples, as the ancient rites required, they made three fires to the three deities Jupiter, Mercury, and Diana, and offered sacrifices to each of them. Brutus himself, holding before the altar of the goddess a consecrated vessel filled with wine and the blood of a white hart, with his face looking up to the image, broke silence in these words. "Goddess of woods, tremendous in the chase, to mountain boars and all the savage race, wide o'er the ethereal walks extend thy sway, and o'er the infernal mansions void of day. Look upon us on earth, unfold our fate, and say what region is our destined seat. Where shall we next thy lasting temples raise, and choirs of virgins celebrate thy praise?" These words he repeated 9 times, after which he took 4 turns around the altar, poured the wine into the fire, and then laid himself down upon the hart's skin, which he had spread before the altar, where he fell asleep. About the 3rd hour of the night, the usual time for deep sleep, the goddess seemed to present herself before him and foretell his future success as follows. "Brutus, there lies beyond the Gallic bounds an island which the western sea surrounds, by giants once possessed, now few remain to bar thy entrance or obstruct thy reign. To reach that happy shore, thy sails employ. Their fate decrees to raise a second Troy, and found an empire in thy royal line, which time shall ne'er destroy, nor bounds confine."
And so Brutus, the disgraced proto-Roman, was promised a second Troy to rule over, and a lineage of kings destined to establish a world empire. And all this he was promised by a pagan goddess. At last, Brutus and his crew arrived in the promised land.
The island was then called Albion, and was inhabited by none but a few giants. Notwithstanding this, the pleasant situation of the places, the plenty of rivers abounding with fish, and the engaging prospect of its woods, made Brutus and his company very desirous to fix their habitation in it. They therefore passed through all the provinces, forced the giants to fly into the caves of the mountains, and divided the country among them according to the directions of their commander. After this they began to till the ground and build houses, so that in a little time the country looked like a place that had been long inhabited. At last Brutus called the island after his own name, Britain, and his companions, Britons. For by these means he desired to perpetuate the memory of his name. From whence afterwards the language of the nation, which first bore the name of Trojan, or rough Greek, was called British.
By ridding the island of its savage inhabitants, and by transforming its untapped resources into property, in roughly the year 1100 BC, Brutus established his claim over Albion, and renamed it after himself. Such is the origin of Britain and of the British race, according to the histories of Nennius and Geoffrey of Monmouth. The British people hail from Aeneas's illegitimate great-grandson, while the Roman people hail from Aeneas's legitimate descendants. The two peoples are, quite literally, cousins. And this brings me to a bit of speculation. Chapter 6. Brutus as Imperial Propaganda. Written between 29 and 19 BC, Virgil's Aeneid provided the most complete version of the Aeneas legend. But the Aeneid is more than just a myth. It was also overt Roman propaganda, commissioned by the Emperor Augustus Caesar himself. As the Republic transformed into an empire around the year zero, Augustus Caesar initiated a momentous propaganda program to, one, portray himself as a god among men, and two, to impart the idea that Roman rule would automatically mean peace and prosperity. So extensive was this program that it included imagery on coins, statuary, and of course, literature. According to Kevin Jeffries in The Propaganda of Augustus Caesar, quote, "Clearly, the poets of the Augustan court were no more than puppets," unquote. Among these puppets was Virgil. In fact, he may have been the chief puppet. In the Aeneid, he goes so far as to explicitly state that Augustus will recreate the primordial utopia, the golden age when Cronos, who the Romans called Saturn, ruled the heavens and the earth, before the reign of Zeus, and before human beings possessed any sort of recognizable knowledge. "Now fix your sight and stand intent to see your Roman race and Julian progeny. The mighty Caesar waits his vital hour, impatient for the world, and grasps his promised power. But next behold the youth of form divine, Caesar himself, exalted in his line, Augustus, promised oft and long foretold, sent to the realm that Saturn ruled of old, born to restore a better age of gold." Propaganda is intended to serve two main purposes: to reassure those who are on your side, and to pacify those who aren't. Therefore, propaganda is not the sort of thing that's hoarded. Rather, it's disseminated far and wide so as to maximize its effectiveness. Bearing this in mind, and knowing that a British myth will later appear which includes the main character of the Aeneid, it's worth noting that right around the time the Aeneid was written, Rome was actively attempting to conquer the British Isles. In 55 BC, 25 years before the Aeneid, Julius Caesar invaded Britain in his expansive Gallic Wars. Despite Caesar's efforts, it would take Rome a total of 98 years to finish the job, finally succeeding in conquering Britain in AD 43, 62 years after the Aeneid. The Brutus myth, and thus Aeneas's connection to Britain, first surfaces in the 9th century AD, as far as we can tell, several centuries after Rome's loss of Britain in 410. There can be no doubt that the British character of Aeneas was borrowed from the Roman character, just like the Romans borrowed the character from the Greeks. The question is, was Aeneas deliberately inserted into the ancient British consciousness by the Romans as a way of pacifying them? What about Brutus? Was he an invention of the Romans? Was he perhaps an indigenous hero of the pre-Roman Britons who was co-opted by the invaders to suit their purposes? Could it be that the relationship between Aeneas and Brutus, or the whole Brutus myth itself, was concocted to convince the native Britons that they and the invading Romans were in fact one people? Not enemies, but long-lost cousins. Interestingly enough, in Aeneas and the Twins, The Development of the Roman Foundation Legend, author T.J. Cornell writes that just such a cultural subversion occurred when the Romans acquired the Aeneas character from the Greeks. He outlines how the Greeks deliberately inserted themselves and their characters into the mythology of foreign and potentially hostile cultures. Remarking on how the Greeks' Aeneas myth was inserted into the indigenous Italian tale of Romulus and Remus, he writes, quote, "At first glance, it would seem that the story of the twins, with its folktale elements, its local connections, relics, and cult associations within the oldest part of the city, was an ancient and indigenous legend, while that of Aeneas, with its patently Greek origin, was a subsequent literary accretion imposed on the Roman tradition from outside. Such a reconstruction of the development of the traditional story accords well with what we know of Greek scholarly methods in dealing with the origins of barbarian peoples. This has been well demonstrated in a masterly paper by E.J. Bickerman. Bickerman examined the way in which Greek scholars tried to reconstruct the prehistory of the inhabited world by rationalizing the myths and legends of the heroic age. The legendary material became a coherent body of pseudo-historical tradition and gave rise to research into genealogies, foundations of cities, and ethnic relationships. Bickerman describes the method as Hellenocentric. That is to say, the Greeks connected the origins of barbarian people with the activities of Greek heroes, and thus incorporated them into the general scheme. For example, it was believed that India had been colonized by Heracles and Dionysus. The Celts, Galatae, were thought to be descended from Polyphemus and Galatia, or, according to another version, from a son of Heracles. In general, Greek researchers made no great effort to ascertain what the peoples in question thought about their own past. When faced with an indigenous tradition, their response was either to ignore it or to reconcile it by artificial means with the Greek version." Unquote. Might the Romans, who borrowed so much from the Greeks, have borrowed this practice of injecting their gods and their heroes into other cultures as well? Might they have used this tactic to expand their empire? Might they have taken an indigenous British myth about a hero named Brutus and combined it with their own Aeneas myth for political gain? It might also be worth noting that the modern word Britain, according to the legend being named for Brutus, actually comes from the Roman name for the colony, Britannia. I want to stress that this is speculative. I have no proof that the Romans deliberately fabricated a story in which a cursed descendant of the hero Aeneas was found unworthy to be king in his own land, so was banished to a faraway island, which the Romans just so happened to be in the middle of colonizing when the Aeneas character was being utilized as a tool of imperial propaganda in Rome. I'm not saying that happened. I'm saying it fits. Whether intentionally or accidentally, the British origin myth has definite ties to Rome. When the Romans left in the early 5th century AD, Britain, or Britannia, as a singular entity, disintegrated. England, Scotland, and Wales were no longer united in any way. In fact, they weren't even nations themselves. The landmass of Britain became a playground for numerous kingdoms, each with its own localized origin myth, and each vying for regional dominance. While the notion of a unified Britain may have been desirable to some of these kings, Such a reality must have been practically inconceivable. It's only at the very end of this extremely fractured age, about 60 years before Alfred the Great claimed the title of king over all Anglo-Saxons, and about 100 years before the official formation of the Kingdom of England under King Æthelstan, that the myth of an ancient, pre-Roman, united Britain under a Trojan founder appears in the writings of an obscure Welsh monk named Nennius. In an age when Britain was effectively broken up into warring tribes, Nennius claimed that they were all one people, Britons. Again, I'm not saying that I have an answer here. I'm just wondering. I wonder, is there any significance to the fact that this unifying origin myth, based in part on ancient Roman imperial propaganda, happened to appear just a few decades before England, the largest and arguably the most influential of the three British kingdoms, finally emerged as a single, unified entity? So, was Nennius's version of the Brutus myth, the first known version of the myth, somehow relevant in the unification of England, which followed soon after its 828 publication? I don't know. Did the Romans deliberately manipulate the culture of an indigenous people by inserting their own characters into it in order to foster a sense of imperial fraternity in the conquered for their conquerors? Did they do it to impart a sense of patriarchal dominance? We are the legitimate sons of Aeneas, and you are his illegitimate sons. Did they even do any of this deliberately at all? I don't know. Sure, according to the cited article, Aeneas and the Twins, the earlier Greeks would employ such culturally subversive tactics. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Romans or the English also did so in these particular circumstances. Nevertheless, while these two particular cases may be plausible, yet still speculative, the technique of deliberately manipulating myths for political ends is crucial to the birth and life of modern imperialism. With that established, let's leave the speculation aside and return to the myth and the history of Britain. Chapter 7. From Myth to History. To summarize, the definitive version of the Brutus myth appears in Geoffrey Monmouth's Historia Regum Britanniae, published in the 1130s. Brutus, the great-grandson of the Trojan hero Aeneas, is banished from Italy, promised an island kingdom of his own by the goddess Diana, and told that his descendants will bring the whole world under their dominion. And then he goes out and gets said island, which he names Britain. Of course, Geoffrey's Historia only begins with Brutus. In its totality, it amounts to a detailed king list, following the exploits of all Britain's legendary kings, from Brutus in the 12th century BC to Cadwallader, who is said to have died in AD 689. It's at this point that the mythic history of a united Britain comes to an end, and the real history of a Britain divided begins. As I've said, the truth is that a divided Britain long preceded the year 689, with the colony fracturing during the course of the Roman exit in the late 4th and early 5th centuries, and remaining fractured through the centuries that followed. Finally, in 885, over 400 years after the end of Roman rule, Alfred the Great became the king of all Anglo-Saxons, the race of migrating Germanic tribesfolk which had become predominant in the land that would soon become England. The native British people were pushed by the Anglo-Saxons into the areas that would become Scotland and Wales. On July 12, 927, Alfred the Great's grandson, Æthelstan, officially formed the Kingdom of England. The first step toward a united Britain was taken, though, again, the actual Britons, the supposed heirs of Brutus, had been pushed out of England by this time. Anglo-Saxon rule over a unified England was to be short-lived, however. In 1066, the Normans, descendants of Vikings who had seized the north of modern-day France, invaded and captured the kingdom. In 1284, Wales was annexed by England during the reign of Edward I, great-grandson of Henry II. In 1707, England and Scotland formally merged to become the Kingdom of Great Britain at last. Chapter 8. Old Empire. One might say that imperialism is woven inextricably through British history. Its origin myth centers on a foreign conqueror. It was conquered by Rome. England was conquered by the Romans in 1066. England took Wales. England long sought to control Scotland and then Ireland, succeeding at times to varying degrees. And in the Middle Ages, the English even had territorial holdings on the European continent. All of these things fit the common conception of what imperialism is, the subjugation of multiple states under one sovereign. Indeed, this fits the definition of the Latin parent word of imperialism, imperium, as it was used in the days of the Roman Empire. However, after the fall of Rome and before the rise of the formal British Empire, imperium meant something slightly different from its more ancient and more modern meanings. Early on in the Roman Republic, imperium was the power of a chosen man, a magistrate, to act for the state. Given that this man was a representative of the people, imperium implied certain limitations. The magistrate didn't possess the authority to infringe upon the rights of free Roman citizens. However, as the Roman state grew, the authority of the domestic magistrates gradually expanded to match the authority held by colonial administrators who were under no obligations to worry about the freedom of non-citizens. In his book, The Ideological Origins of the British Empire, historian David Armitage writes, quote, "As the distinction between domestic and military authority was no longer recognized, imperium came to mean unlimited authority in any sphere," unquote. Eventually, this total power, this imperium, came to be embodied in one man. Writes Armitage, quote, "By the time of the Principate, the emperors carried the supreme authority over all of the people and territories of that imperium Romanum. Their authority didn't go unchallenged in practice, but in theory, it could not be legitimately supplemented, diluted, or replaced. Imperium now denoted ultimate, self-sufficient, indivisible authority over a territorial expanse, formerly known as the empire itself." Unquote. Given that the Romans conquered virtually all of the world known to them, it's no surprise that pretty early on, they claimed Imperium Orbis, an empire of the world. The Roman Empire was global, universal, and its authority absolute. Until it fell. No longer was there any obvious global power. Rather, the three major entities left in the wake of Rome's destruction, the Byzantine Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, and the Roman Catholic Church, each claimed universal imperium for itself. Of course, there can't be three universal empires, so the term imperium, in its universal sense, fell out of use. Instead, more localized authorities began to use it in a less grandiose fashion. Rather than represent global dominance, the medieval conception of imperium came to mean regional, internal control. Æthelstan, the first king of United England, called himself Imperator. Edgar I fancied himself Emperor and Lord of England. In fact, Edward I, Richard II, and Henry V were all called Emperor at one point or another. But in each case, the king was only emperor of his little region, not of the world, but of England alone. According to Armitage, quote, "Late medieval and early modern rulers made increasingly frequent claims to independent imperium. Such claims were particular rather than universal. They did not suggest any intention to compete with the Holy Roman or Byzantine Emperor or the Pope for supremacy, but asserted both independence from external interference and ascendancy over internal competitors. For example, lawyers for the French monarchy asserted that the King of France was an imperator in regno suo from the 14th century onwards. This was not a claim to parity with the Pope or Emperor. Instead, it was an assertion of the French king's power over the clergy and the nobility within France itself, derived from the Roman principle of plenitudo potestatis. This was a claim to internal authority rather than external power, an assertion of royal supremacy, not national self-determination, and therefore a statement not of independence from outside authority, but rather of predominance over internal competitors. Unquote. In 1469, the Catholic King James III of Scotland proclaimed his, quote, full jurisdiction and free empire, unquote, over Scotland. James's use of the term empire demonstrates that the word was more or less synonymous with government or sovereignty, as these terms apply to the rulership of a monarch. James's empire conspicuously lacked the expansive colonial implications that the term once carried with it and soon would again. However, just as in the Roman Republic, imperium was originally limited by the rights of free citizens, this late medieval local imperium claimed by kings was limited by the global imperium claimed by the Catholic Church, the Holy Roman Empire, and the Byzantine Empire. A king's imperium could only exist within one of these three larger powers. The Holy Roman Empire lost its teeth in the early 14th century, and the Byzantine Empire fell to the Ottoman Empire in 1453, leaving the Roman Catholic Church as the sole contender for the role of Imperator Orbis. And while the Catholic, which means universal, Church could only dominate the world in theory, it could, in practice, quite effectively control those regions in its immediate vicinity, namely Western and Central Europe. Thus, in Britain, which was located on Catholic turf, any sovereignty claimed by a king over his land would essentially have to be approved by the Church. Given that, by definition, sovereignty means independent of external authority, no king at the time was really a sovereign at all. In the Catholic world, a king was only king so long as the Pope said he was king. And for the majority of medieval history, agents of the Church were granted what effectively amounts to diplomatic immunity within these supposedly sovereign local empires. For instance, consider the story of Thomas Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury, who in 1170 was unjustly slain by King Henry II's barons. For his crime against the Church, the king, allegedly the sovereign in his land, was stripped and flogged by monks. However, as the sun dawned on the year 1500, as the Renaissance swept the continent, and as the first European ships landed on American shores, this limited conception of sovereignty, and therefore of empire, changed considerably. Chapter 9. New Empire. There were four critical factors that pulled Europe out of the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. The Crusades brought about the rediscovery of classical political philosophy. The printing press offered a new medium of communication. The arrival of Europeans in the Americas presented a new world of potential political activity. And finally, the Reformation introduced new, decentralized versions of Christianity, providing Western Europeans an alternative to the Catholic or Universal Church. Of these, the most crucial to the development of the modern concept of imperialism is, without a doubt, the Reformation. Even though the Reformation only ever produced variants of Christianity, and the early forms of Protestantism, such as Lutheranism and Anglicanism, very closely resembled their Catholic parent, at the time, even these seemingly conservative dissidents were making a very bold and very dangerous claim that the Pope is not Christ's supreme agent on earth. In the case of Lutheranism, this meant that every man was his own priest, that no middleman was needed to connect the individual with the divine. In the case of Anglicanism, that is, the Church of England, it meant that the monarch, the head of state, was also the head of the Church. He or she was Christ's supreme agent on earth. Naturally, this shift in the seat of divine authority from the Pope in Rome to the monarch in London led to the alteration of the idea of sovereignty, returning it in a way to its Roman conception of a god emperor whose authority was unbridled. In the short term, this new understanding guaranteed a feud between Britain and Rome, those two heirs of Troy. In the long run, it meant the rise of Imperium Orbis Britanniae. The new imperialism developed in two distinct, though intimately connected, phases. Phase one was put to paper in one of the most important documents of the English Reformation, the Act in Restraint of Appeals, passed in 1533 during the reign of King Henry VIII, explicitly prohibits any English citizen, layman or holyman, from making any appeal to the Pope or the Roman Catholic Church. In all matters, even in spiritual matters, it is the King of England who is to have the final word. A king, at last, would be a true sovereign. Quote, "Whereby divers sundry old authentic histories and chronicles it is manifestly declared and expressed that this realm of England is an empire, and so hath been accepted in the world, governed by one supreme head and king, having the dignity and royal estate of the imperial crown of the same, unto whom a body politic, compact of all sorts and degrees of people, divided in terms and by names of spirituality and temporality, be bounden and owe to bear next to God a natural and humble obedience, he being also institute and furnished by the goodness and sufferance of Almighty God with plenary, whole and entire power, preeminence, authority, prerogative, and jurisdiction to render and yield justice and final determination to all manner of folk resiance or subjects within his realm, in all causes, matters, debates, and contentions happening to occur, insurge, or begin with the limits thereof, without restraint or provocation to any foreign princes or potentates of the world." Unquote. Perhaps this isn't an evolution of the idea of empire, but a devolution, a return to the older, late Roman conception of a divine ruler unrestricted by any external power. Be it a progression or a regression, the fact remains that with this act, Henry VIII became the true sovereign of his realm, the true master of his kingdom. According to this declaration, any action based on the presumption that there was a higher earthly authority than the king was not only illegitimate, it was illegal. Crucial as Henry's sovereignty is to the rise of modern imperialism, it's only half the recipe. In The British Empire, C.H. Firth writes, quote, "According to the New English Dictionary, the word empire meant in Henry VIII's time a country of which the sovereign owes no allegiance to any foreign superior. A little later, the word came to signify a composite state formed by the union of two or more states." Unquote. Going from a state ruled by a true sovereign to a union or collection of states ruled by a single true sovereign represents phase two of the development of the modern concept of empire. Again, as with phase one, perhaps this development is better characterized as a devolution than as evolution, a return to an older, even ancient, conception of empire. So much of the Renaissance, and therefore modernity, is founded upon a rediscovery and reapplication of the ancient as a rejection of medieval norms. So why should imperialism be any different? Anyway, phase two represents the shift from empire as an insular body politic to empire as an expansive body politic. However, adding a twist to the ancient modes of imperialism, this new empire in the making would not merely conquer for the sake of conquering, though it would certainly not hesitate to use force when necessary, but its ultimate intent was, in theory, to progress towards the restoration of a primordial, mythic state of unity. David Armitage writes in The Ideological Origins of the British Empire, occasionally quoting the Anglo-Scottish Unionist James Henryson, "The renewed attempts between 1547-50 by the Edwardian regimes," that would be Henry's son, Edward VI, to enforce Anglo-Scottish dynastic union, whether by persuasion or by fire and sword, generated a conception of a British Empire that was Protestant, commercially expansive, bounded by the sea, and inhabited by the subjects of two free and independent kingdoms united under one head. This monarchy would be called British because it traced its origins back to its first king, Brutus, and reunited the Isle of Britain under a single ruler. The inhabitants of the island over which Brutus had ruled were the original, ethnic Britons, though in due course they had become mingled with the Scots and the English. The, quote, "one sole monarchy shall be called Britain," unquote, and its subjects would, quote, "take the indifferent old name of Britons again," unquote. It could also be called an empire for good historical reasons. Though the earliest Britons had, quote, "lost their name and empire," unquote, through sin and discord, their English and Scottish descendants had been reunited when Britain became a province of the Roman Empire, and when the British-born Christian Constantine, not the first Christian Constantine the Great Constantine, a different Constantine, had become emperor, quote, "all Britain was under one emperor, and being under one emperor, then was Scotland and England but one empire," unquote. The symbols of that British Empire remained as emblems of the English monarchy, the Red Cross, originally borne by Constantine, and, quote, "a close crown imperial, in token that the land is an empire free in itself and subject to no superior but God," unquote. In 1547, the very same year that James Henryson made those imperialistic proclamations, a rather prominent man in Henry VIII's government, Edward Seymour, 1st Duke of Somerset, big brother of Jane Seymour, Henry's third wife, Lord High Treasurer, Lord Great Chamberlain, and Lord Protector of the Realm, advocated for the English annexation of Scotland. However, what he advised was not the typical brutish bang-em-over-the-head conquest, but rather, like Henryson, he recommended the melding of the two nations into a single Protestant polity, with England in the dominant position, of course. In England Under Protector Somerset, published in 1900, A.F. Pollard writes, quote, "When Somerset took up the question of the union with Scotland, he informed it with ideas that were peculiar to himself, and raised him above the level of the self-seeking courtiers with whom he was surrounded. That union was to be no mere union of the crowns, but a complete incorporation of the two realms into a body politic. In addition to other details of the plan, he proposed that the names England and English, Scotland and Scottish, should be abolished, and the United Kingdom be called the Empire, and its sovereign, the Emperor, of Great Britain," unquote. Somerset's 1547 recommendation offers us with the first known use of the term, and the first known application of the modern concept, of Empire of Great Britain. Somerset's empire was not confined to England, rather it would encapsulate the whole of Britain and reinstitute the Great Britain of King Brutus. Others who pushed for such a union went even further than Somerset and appealed directly to Britain's mythic history. Says Armitage, "the most elaborate exposition of the Tudor claim to the Scots throne, Nicholas Bodrigan's Epitome of the Title that the King's Majesty of England hath to the Sovereignty of Scotland, 1548, recalled that Somerset's supposed ancestor, Eldulf de Samur, had repelled a Saxon invasion, whereby, quote, "this realm was delivered from the tyranny of Saxons and restored to the whole empire and name of Great Britain," unquote. That empire had its origins in Brutus's monarchy and had been affirmed later by the Scots' reception of English law, the ecclesiastical supremacy of the Archbishop of York over the Scottish bishops, and the feudal submission of Scotland, a nation, quote, "from the beginning, inseparably appendant to the crown of this realm," unquote. The centuries of civil strife between the kingdoms of England and Scotland had renewed the divisions within Britain. It would be the task of the English to restore unity to the island, as they had done in the past. true sovereignty and a blood duty to reestablish a mythical ancient kingdom, here is the conception of the British Empire. During this embryonic period, the primary concern of the imperialists was not the colonization of foreign lands, but the unification of Britain itself. And the Brutus tale was the central piece of pro-Union propaganda peddled by the imperialists. In truth, this was not a British project. It was primarily an English project. Many Scots were wary of Union and were skeptical about this fantastical story about a legendary kingdom from 1100 BC. Although the legend was intended to foster feelings of fraternity and camaraderie between the Scots and the English, many Scots simply didn't identify with the tale. Perhaps the veil was too thin. The Scottish monarchy and the Protestant Scottish Church opposed Union, while Scottish scholars offered thoughtful rebuttals to the English's utopian yarns. Based largely on the impressive work of the Italian humanist and student of English history, Polydore Vergil, Scottish thinkers denied the premise of the English's Britain myth. There was no Brutus. He was just a character. Therefore, there was no ancient British Empire, much less one that the English somehow had the primary rights to. And yet, it was for just such an empire that Englishmen like the Duke of Somerset quite literally argued for the annihilation of Scottish and English national identity itself. For many Scots, this wasn't merely a case of those silly English believing in children's stories. It was a challenge of divine import. The moral test of a nation is whether or not it defends itself against tyranny. If it does, it's rewarded with freedom. But if it doesn't, it's punished with the very tyranny it failed to prevent. Despite the Scottish resistance, the English eventually got their united Britain, though it came at the cost of the Tudor dynasty itself, the dynasty which had set the project of union in motion. Elizabeth I, the final Tudor monarch, left no heirs. The crown was thus passed to James of the Stuart House. In 1603, he became King James I of England. But at this time, he was already King James VI of Scotland. So in that year, with the replacement of the Tudor dynasty with the Stuart, England and Scotland were brought under the rule of a single monarch. Now, this didn't amount to the kind of union that Somerset and his ilk sought, where national identities broke down and everyone just became British. That would come later. Nah, England and Scotland remained technically independent nations which just so happened to share a king, explaining James's somewhat clunky and awkward title of King James the Sixth and First. Nonetheless, with England and Scotland under the same crown, ambitious imperialists finally turned their gaze outward and contemplated the foundation of foreign colonies. In 1607, just 4 years after James's ascendancy in England, the Virginia Company of London founded the first permanent English, or British, settlement in North America, a little outpost called James Fort. In 1619, its name was changed to Jamestown. Britain was in the New World. Chapter 10. Interlude. The British Empire is an ideological construct, a manufactured political unity based on a myth. While it may be that the very notion of Britishness has its origins in the Roman conquest of the island, by the end of the 16th century, the idea of a single, united British people was being promoted and leveraged by a small group of predominantly English political figures. Though much of this talk of Britishness served as propaganda to veil the commercial and political ambitions of wealthy Englishmen, it came with ideological baggage as well. For some, the expansion of Britain would mean the proliferation of superior morals and statecraft. For some, it represented the only meaningful opposition to the Roman Church. Even the commercialism of the empire is rooted, at least in theory, in the ideological belief that increased material prosperity would make for a better, more civilized world. As time went on, and as Britain spread itself around the world, these ideological pretensions would only continue to swell until some of the late empire's most prominent advocates came to believe that the imperial project would effectively end in a well-fed, well-bred, well-mannered, technological global utopia. But, toward the end of the 16th century, long before any of the utopian fantasies of the Victorian and Edwardian ages came into view, the early, ambitious English imperialists, speaking for the whole of Britain, had to justify British expansion and colonialism, particularly in the Americas. By then, the Spanish had been in a very lucrative part of the New World for nearly 100 years, giving them a clear advantage over any would-be competitor. And this is on top of the fact that, because the Spanish had been the first Christians to arrive in the Americas in 1492, the Catholic Church had granted them virtual ownership of the continents, including regions undiscovered at that time. This momentous donation was based on the legal principle of first discovery. That is, whoever's first to find unowned land gets the first chance to develop it. Thus, the Spanish, and to a much lesser extent the Portuguese, for providing Columbus safe passage when he returned to Europe, these two nations were effectively given the entirety of the Americas to develop by the head of the Roman Catholic Church himself. It also probably didn't hurt that the Pope at the time of Columbus's so-called discovery, Pope Alexander VI, was in fact Rodrigo Borgia, scion of that notorious family of Spanish oligarchs. He declared in 1493, quote, "Out of our own soul largesse and certain knowledge, and out of the fullness of our apostolic power, by the authority of Almighty God conferred upon us in Blessed Peter, and of the vicarship of Jesus Christ, which we hold on earth, do by tenor of these presents, should any of said islands have been found by your envoys and captains, give, grant, and assign to you and your heirs and successors, kings of Castile and Leon, forever, together with all their dominions, cities, camps, places, and villages, and all rights, jurisdictions, and appurtenances, all islands and mainlands found and to be found, discovered and to be discovered toward the west and south, by drawing and establishing a line from the Arctic Pole, namely the north, to the Antarctic Pole, namely the south, no matter whether the said mainlands and islands are found and to be found in the direction of India or towards any other quarter, the said line to be distant 100 leagues toward the west and south from any of the islands commonly known as the Azores and Cape Verde. With this proviso, however, that none of the islands and mainlands found and to be found, discovered and to be discovered, beyond that said line toward the west and south, be in the actual possession of any Christian king or prince up to the birthday of our Lord Jesus Christ, just past from which the present year 1493 begins. And we make, appoint, and depute you and your said heirs and successors, lords of them with full and free power, authority, and jurisdiction of every kind." Unquote. Of course, the decades following the turn of the century brought the Reformation, and thus the question was raised, just how much power does the Pope really have? Is it within the rights of the Bishop of Rome to simply grant vast swathes of land, literal continents, to less than a handful of royals, just because they paid a guy who found a couple islands nearby? If you believe that the Pope is the vicar of Christ, the official representative of God on earth, then sure, why not? But what if you don't believe that? What if the Pope is just the head of a church, not the church? If there was ever to be a British Empire in the Americas, the Iberian property claim must first be refuted. And the only claim that the Iberians had over the Americas was the right of first discovery. Therefore, to assert their legal and spiritual dominion over the New World, the unscrupulous imperialists actually claimed that Britain possessed the right of first discovery. In an essay entitled The Struggle for Legitimacy, published in the Oxford History of the British Empire, Volume 1, The Origins of Empire, Anthony Pagin writes, "The need to sustain claims to prior discovery against those made by rival powers resulted in some very far-fetched readings of the early history of the European voyages, and a prolonged debate over who had been the first to reach America. The problem for the English and the French was the primacy of Columbus's first voyage. The only way to challenge this was to find even earlier transatlantic voyages. The yoking of Welsh and English history by the ascension of the Tudor dynasty and the Acts of Union of 1536 and 1543 allowed the voyages of a fictional Welshman, Prince Madoc, who had supposedly fled civil war in 1170 to what is now Alabama, to be presented as evidence that, in Hakluyt's words, quote, "the West Indies were discovered and inhabited 325 years before Columbus made his first journey," unquote. And if this seemed a rather weak basis for territorial occupation, he added, somewhat more plausibly, that it had been the Cabots, the famous explorers, sailing English ships and under English instructions, who had, quote, "first discovered Florida, the North American mainland, for the King of England," unquote. However, merely seeing new lands or merely planting a flag somewhere did not constitute rightful ownership, argued the British. For land to be property, it must be transformed by labor, developed. This argument would later be used to justify taking the land from the natives. Given that the Spanish had only actually settled and developed very little of the New World, their claim over the entirety of the Americas was null and void, argued the British, even if the claim was underwritten by the Pope. Therefore, to truly challenge the Iberian claim, the brash imperialists not only had to show that their predecessors had found the New World first, they had to show that their predecessors had settled it first, too. And to do so, they had no choice but to appeal to a mythic, thousand-year-old utopia. Though such appeals may seem dubious at best to a modern audience, and though they were quickly forgotten and replaced by more sophisticated justifications for colonization, these appeals to a past utopia served as the all-important spark for the imperial flame that would soon engulf the world, a purifying flame that would, it was hoped, give rise to a future utopia. So here we are, in the closing decades of the 16th century, with a new idea of empire as union of multiple nations under one sovereign, with a new religion in which the head of state is the head of the church, and with a whole new world ripe for the picking and in need of salvation. We are now at the cusp of modernity, but in order to build the state of the future, the agents of progress would need to conjure up a state from the legendary past. At last, we come to the Golden Age myth that birthed Britannia. End of part one.
bair ferch yn gryno nad oedd i'n lodion nir. Mae'r ffordd yn ddigon llydan a'r llwybrau'n ddigon tig. A chwyth o'i lenc yn gwisgu ewch efo glan y dŵr. Mae digon o'r man gychod, mae digon o man gychod, gewch pas efo rhain yn siŵr. Sydd o'n nadledwch ddim yn gas. Nad yw y ferch yn gartref, mae hwyll ystan y tŷ. Llawg ifanc o'r plwy arall, llawg ifanc o'r plwy arall sydd wedi mynd â hi.